This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Kitchen Sisters have searched America for the sounds and voices that capture our time and the recent past. They describe their work as chronicling the hidden parts of history, the traditions and rituals that people carry with them. The Kitchen Sisters, who aren't really sisters, are Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. In conjunction with Jay Allison, they've produced the NPR series Lost and Found Sound, the Sonic Memorial Project, and Hidden Kitchens. They've won 2 Peabody Awards. Now they have a new book called Hidden Kitchens, adapted from their radio series. Hidden Kitchens isn't so much about food itself as it is about the meaning of food in people's lives and how people get together around food. The Kitchen Sisters searched for stories, as they often do, by asking NPR listeners to call with their suggestions.
Message 23 was received at 1:10 p.m. today.
I'm Margaret Engel, a woman who works for Legal Aid, who's talking to me about how many of her clients get dinner. The people who struggle to even get food on the table because they don't have an official kitchen and who are using George Foreman grills and the like. The George Foreman grill has been an amazing success story as a kitchen appliance, but what I think many people don't realize is that immigrants and low-income people have contributed to that popularity. That is, to me, the epitome of the hidden kitchen.
Wow. What a wonderful story. I'd never considered it at all. I'm George Foreman, 2-time heavyweight champion of the world, former Olympic champion, and king of the grills. Growing up in Houston, Texas, my whole life was spent trying to get enough to eat. Having 7 kids, my mother did, and there just was never enough food for me. I always dreamed about not a car, not a beautiful home, but enough to eat.
My name, Piggly Wiggly. I've got groceries on my shelf.
My name is Jeffrey Newton, Chicago. I'm a great cook, a trait that I had learned from my grandmother, but I just haven't had a kitchen. I'm living in a shelter at this particular time, but I've been homeless all my life. I lived under Wacker Drive, where the expressway goes through, and there's about 30 or 40 refrigerator boxes down there. That's going to be your home. I would get the George Foreman grill. That's the grill that I had for a while under Wacker Drive, me and a fellow by the name of Smokey. So you just get your long extension cord. Well, they got a lot of electrical plugs on the poles down there. And just hook up. We just making hamburgers.
Nikki Silva, Davia Nelson, welcome to Fresh Air. Real pleasure to have you on our show. The George Foreman story is such a wonderful story. I mean, I never would have considered that people who are homeless can cook food with the help of a Foreman grill, or like how useful an electric grill is if you're living in an SRO. But let me back up a little bit here. How did you first come up with the idea for Hidden Kitchens?
Well, Davia lives in San Francisco, and she hates to drive. She takes taxi cabs every place. And she started noticing that all these cab drivers, particularly in the yellow cab company, were Brazilian. And, you know, she started talking with them, and, of course, they talked about food and music. And whenever they talked about food, this woman, Jeanette, came up in the conversation, and it turns out that there was this woman who was from their same hometown, Goiânia. All these guys are from Goiânia. And this woman from Goiânia would set up each night in the cab yard outside the yellow cab company, set up a blue tent, and cook the food of their hometown. And the men would come, and pretty soon other cab drivers started to come, and she was just sort of gathering her community like a campfire, and these men were finding home and community through her cooking. And so we headed down there to see what that was all about. It sounded like a real Kitchen Sisters kind of story. And we just began to think, if Jeanette is doing this here with music and people and language and community, then who else is out there? And it sort of got us thinking about little hidden kitchen economies in the rest of the country and what was happening on street corners and how were things changing and who were the unsung kitchen heroes that were bringing their communities together. And that's how it was born.
As with some other projects that you've done, you found people by putting the word out on All Things Considered that you were looking for people who had these hidden kitchens. Then you asked them to call and leave a message on an answering machine. Have you found this technique to be, you know, really effective, putting the word out on the radio and then waiting for people to call in?
Absolutely. Somehow the answering machine is sort of almost like this natural microphone. People know how to talk into a phone. It's not intimidating. And people love to give you the lowdown, the secret, the thing below the radar, something only they know about, whether it's some extraordinary old piece of tape that they have or some little hidden kitchen that they know about that's tucked away or some kitchen ritual that's just theirs or their communities. And somehow the way that phone line works, just thousands of people keep calling it and wanting to spill the beans.
Do you get a lot of crank calls and obscene calls?
You know, remarkably few. More we get product people. They think, for your Hidden Kitchen series now, we have knives. We have a special folding table. I mean, when you hear those kind of messages, we also get a lot of people how my dissertation is on the tradition of pierogies in the basements of Polish halls in an upper section of Ohio, accessible only by cattle car. You know, I mean, things so obscure, but so heartfelt. And so a lot of people sort of are pitching their unpublished novels.
In your Hidden Kitchens book, you say that you think food is really about fellowship. And of course, who could argue with that? But I was wondering, do you like to eat alone too? And do you guys ever eat alone, either at home or in a restaurant?
Me? I don't like to eat alone. This is Nikki. I'd rather not eat.
Really? Why is that?
I don't know. I think I just take a lot more pleasure out of the conversation and the making of it than actually even the eating of it for me.
Well, Nikki lives on a commune. You should know that, Terry. So she's lived on a commune for 27 years. So when Nikki sits down to dinner, there are three families there, and they cook one night a week each. And she's eating on an epic level every single evening.
And Devia, what about you? Do you eat alone ever?
Sometimes I eat alone. Yeah, I actually like eating alone. I like eating with people more, absolutely. And I like eating... You know, I'm out a lot on the road doing these stories, so a lot of the times I'm eating by myself there. And something about being alone, you may start out at the table alone, but you're almost never alone by the end of it.
Something I am.
Happens.
I'm always alone at the end of it. newspaper or my book.
Really, I pick up strays. I don't know. There's something. I'm sort of always scanning the perimeter. And
Davia's parents taught her to talk to strangers.
Yeah, I think that's true. And my father, from when I was really little, brought me into the back of restaurants to show me. There was this one Italian restaurant in L.A. that he loved because it reminded him of New York, where he was from, and Little Italy. And so he was always bringing me as a little girl into the back of it. So I think somewhere I didn't learn about those boundaries, the places in restaurants you're not supposed to go. And I don't know, there's always a good story back there somewhere.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the Kitchen Sisters. That's Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. And I'm sure you've heard a lot of their pieces on National Public Radio and All Things Considered in Morning Edition. And their new book, Hidden Kitchens, is a collection of stories and recipes from their Hidden Kitchens NPR series. And there's also an audiobook version with the actual pieces in them. Let's talk a little bit about an earlier series that you did, Lost and Found Sound. And why don't you describe what the series was?
It was a series that we created at the turn of the century for the millennium. And we turned to the country and we said, we're looking for how sound has shaped history and history's been shaped by sound, people possessed by sound, sound on the verge of extinction. How is the soundtrack of America changing, vanishing voices, shifting accents? And that was the first time we opened up that phone line on NPR. And we said to the nation, this was a big collaboration with All Things Considered, with independent producers, with artists from all kinds of mediums, with musicians, you name it. Everyone was involved with that project. So some 1,500 people worked on it. Anyway, we opened up this phone line and people all around the country sent in stories and recordings. And we set out, there are 92 stories now in the Lost and Found Sound collection.
Now, in your Lost and Found Sound series, there's a combination of like rare archival recordings from well-known people, you know, important cultural and historical figures. And there's also just kind of found recordings, like ephemeral recordings that weren't even supposed to last, made at penny arcades and made on home cassette machines. And that we don't even have the means to play back because the playback versions, the playback technology for these recordings barely exists anymore. But so you know, it's this wonderful mix of, you know, unprofessional recordings of every sort. What got you interested in that kind of recording?
Well, we were doing a live radio program. That's how Davia and I started working together 25 years ago on a little community radio station in Santa Cruz, California, KUSP. And we did this live show, which was music and interviews and very eclectic. We would, filmmakers would come through town and we'd interview filmmakers and writers. And we were searching for old recordings. You know, we'd played a lot of old jazz. And my dad has had this notorious garage where everything you could ever want was in this garage. And when we started doing this show, he said, well, you know, we've got some 78s in the garage, your mom's 78s. So we hauled this huge box of 78s back to the station and started going through them. And one of the records was in a plain brown wrapper, and it was just handwritten, "To Louie, Love, Mrs. B." And it was a 78 recording. We put it on, and it was this woman, Mrs. B, and we still don't know who she is, and my father doesn't know who she is. His name's Ernie, not Louie. And we put this on, and it was a woman in her kitchen using a home recording machine, which were popular during the 40s and 50s, and she was talking to her husband, who was overseas during World War II. And there was just something about this woman's voice and her use of language and words, you know. "Do they jitterbug over there, Louie? Gee, Lou, they don't dance as good as we do. Do they, hun?" I mean, just a sort of anxiousness and love and concern. And, you know, "We'll ski in 43. Gee, Lou, I hope so." There was something about this woman's voice that just captured all these things we'd read about. But, you know, how do you portray that in words? I mean, it was her voice. It was her soul coming through her voice that really caught us. And we began asking around. And almost everybody we talked to had some home recording in their attic or in their stereo console or something tucked away, that an old recording that their family had done. You know, my mother had done one at the boardwalk in Santa Cruz. She said she used to sing like, she thought she sang like Ella Fitzgerald. You know, she'd get in there and just sing away. So we began gathering these things, and we just found, wow, what a window, what an ear into the past these recordings were. And that was the beginning. We began on that little radio show, sort of exploring that avenue, and that really came through. It's come through in all the stuff we've done since.
I think you really found a kindred spirit in a way when you started working with Sam Phillips, the great Sam Phillips, who founded Sun Records and, you know, was the first to record Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Charlie Rich, Roy Orbison, and So you went down to talk with him, not about Sun Records, but about the era right before that, when he was running something called the Memphis Recording Service, which did what?
We record anything, anywhere, anytime. That was the slogan of the Memphis Recording Service. And that was his operation that sort of bankrolled everything else he was doing with all the musicians. It was just the bread and butter that kept him solvent, or barely solvent at the time. And he would go and record funerals and weddings and talent shows, anything you could think of, beauty contests. And he'd just show up with his tape recorder and convince people that they really wanted to get this documented. Then he'd print the records and he'd sell them to everybody who was in attendance.
Well, let's play an excerpt of the piece that you did about Sam Phillips. And he's talking here about why he wanted to record funerals for his Memphis Recording Service.
"Jehovah is my shepherd. He maketh me to lie down in green pasture."
To keep my little studio Memphis Recording Service open, I had to record many different things. Now, I went in as a very young man to talk to the manager of National Funeral Home about recording funerals. Most people had never thought of anything like that. He wanted to know how in the world could people be approached at a time like that to make a recording. I told him that, Lord of mercy, I would under no circumstances interfere with quote-unquote whatever the flavor of the funeral was and the intimacy of it, how much more intimate could you be than to hear the minister or feel the crowd, or if there's somebody that's crying or something like that? The sound made you smell it, taste it, feel it through your bones, your entire body, I mean your soul. And when I got through talking to this man, I convinced him to let me record funerals. He gave me restrictions. I mean, the mic could not be in sight. I have hid it in little wreaths and sprays. Marion did one for me. I had to stand in Marion Kaisker. I had gone out and set it up for her and everything. All she had to do was stay behind the curtain and turn the little recorder on. She said, "Sam, how in the world did you ever think of?" I said, "Well, if you are out of money," and I was looking for sources, frankly, to make money to do what I wanted to do.
That's Sam Phillips, as recorded for Lost and Found Sound by the Kitchen Sisters, my guests, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. I feel like you really found a kindred spirit in him, because, like, hearing him talk about what the sound did, you know, the sound of the funeral made you taste it and feel it through your body to your soul. You feel that way about sound, don't you?
I think the best compliment we were ever given on the planet Earth was Sam Phillips saying, "I think you know something about the acoustics of life." I mean,
oh,
Sam
so
Phillips.
Great.
Oh, it's this thing, if, you know, it will be on the Kitchen Sister grave marker, I'll tell you. And he, you know, no matter, there, Sam Phillips for us was like going back to Thomas Edison. I mean, he was ground zero for sound of the century. When we first even imagined the idea of Lost and Found Sound, Sam, we brought it to Sam Phillips, and he kind of gave us his blessing, and he gave us his time. And no matter what we were working on, he had some take on it that just sent us reeling and sent us spinning and back and forth to Memphis. Ultimately, we did four stories out of there. He sold Sun Studios. You probably know this. He sold Elvis Presley's contract and opened up the first all-girl radio station in the nation in 1955. I mean, you know, the same guy that would record Rufus Thomas or B.B. King or Jerry Lee Lewis would imagine an all-girl station. This guy was just, he was lighting the path.
And one of the most interesting moments, I think, in the history of public radio conferences was when you brought Sam Phillips to the annual public radio conference at which, you know, people from all the NPR stations used to meet and, you know, discuss NPR issues and programming and stuff. And there in the middle of this conference was, like, Sam Phillips. And it was this kind of like meeting of two worlds, and you were right in the middle. Like, you were the intermediary between Sam Phillips and everybody else in public radio. What was that like for you to bring him to the conference?
He just grabbed the mic and ran. We had no way of knowing where he was going to go with it or what he was going to do. It was beautiful. It was inspirational.
Sam was on a wavelength of his own, and Sam was almost like a preacher. He was preaching the gospel of sound. He said to us, "I can end wars with sound." And I think he just was on a mission with his music. When he opened his mouth, he was never going to stop. And I don't think public radio will ever be quite the same. We also had, because Memphis is the headquarters of FedEx, we had FedExed 400 pounds of ribs in from Memphis as well. So something about that smell of the ribs and Sam's stories. And then Sam's son, Knox, stood up in the midst of it, and he sort of testified. It was one of the more holy moments in public radio.
There's one other project I want to ask you about, and that's the project you did after September 11th, the Sonic Memorial Project. How did you figure out what you wanted to do to document the life and death of the World Trade Towers?
We thought, we know what having voices means. We know what archival recordings mean to people, and we know what these little phone messages can mean. And we don't just mean the last words, not only that, those last recordings, but we called Verizon right after 9/11, a few days after 9/11, and we said, "We know the towers went down, but usually voicemail isn't in the towers, isn't in the physical building, the same building as the telephones are." And we were thinking about all those thousands and thousands of voicemail messages. Some people would have perished, some people were still alive, but we just thought even the most mundane thing, like someone's voice saying, you know, meet me for lunch at 2 o'clock on Wednesday, let alone the final messages. And we thought if we could get those messages to the families of people from the buildings, that would be important to them. Some were having those little recordings, those most present recordings. So we got through finally to Verizon. Verizon said, yes, in fact, those messages still exist. And the automatic telephone janitoring system had kicked in. I guess this must have been about 10 days because you know how your messages get deleted after a certain amount of days. The first batch of messages had been deleted. And so we were sort of in this race against time. Somehow this became our way to connect, you know, how everyone wanted to do something. Anyway, Verizon worked with us, and they... anyone that wanted to get their a hard copy of the messages, because the voicemail system was down, they helped us to get those messages to family, the contents of those voicemail box. And then it led us to the idea of opening that phone line on NPR and asking people, and WNYC, they were extremely part of that project. And we just reached out around the country, but we said, let's not just contemplate 9/11, let's look into the whole recorded history of Lower Manhattan, and let's celebrate the life and acknowledge the history and honor the death and take a retrospective look of this piece of ground, this land, and look at the life and history through these archival recordings. And that led to the Sonic Memorial.
Well, let me play an excerpt of the Sonic Memorial Project. And we're going to hear a judge who married people at the top of the World Trade Center at Windows of the World, Windows on the World, and then we're going to hear somebody who actually got married there. Do you want to introduce this for us and tell us about these marriage ceremonies that took place there?
It was odd because it was one of the first stories that we aired, and it was so not what you would think of when you think of what had just happened at the Trade Towers, but I think it really resonated with people that this building had a history, it had a life, it was about love, it was about business, it was about daily life, and it wasn't just about the destruction. And in that way, I think this was an important piece.
Well, here's an excerpt of the piece that you did about people who got married at the top of the World Trade Center.
Welcome you to the World Trade Center. I'm Judge Frederick Berman, and it's my pleasure to be able to...
I'm Judge Frederick Berman. For many years, I've had the pleasure and privilege of performing weddings on Valentine's Day atop the World Trade Center. We did 3 an hour, every 20 minutes. They would put ads in papers around the country and abroad saying, if you are interested in getting married atop the World Trade Center on Valentine's Day, write us a letter and tell us why you would like to do it. The weddings that I actually performed, I have copies of all those letters so that I could personalize each of the ceremonies. The top cards are my notes. They met at the World Trade Center 2 years ago. He works in the food and beverage department.
My name is Enrique Mejia, and I work in the food and beverage department. I wrote that I just couldn't see myself getting married nowhere else but up here.
I was working downstairs as a tour guide. He was working up here. So it's like everything happened here. We got engaged last year about Valentine's. He called me over to the window to see the view, and then he just popped the question. And everybody from the food and beverage came with wine glasses and just started celebrating it.
My family's in Jersey, so my mother talked about she's scared of Vegas, so... she wasn't coming. Her family's the same thing. They're scared of elevators, the heights. So we told them 107th floor. They were like, no, no, that's all right. When you finish, come see us.
That's an excerpt from the Kitchen Sisters piece about people who got married at the World Trade Center, part of their Sonic Memorial Project. When was that interview with the couple recorded? It almost sounds like it was recorded at the World Trade Center before it was attacked.
Yes, exactly. It wasn't a post. There, it was someone recording them when they were there for their wedding.
Oh, exactly. I see. It was actually recorded at the wedding.
Yes, exactly.
It's archival tape.
Yes, exactly. It's archival tape.
Oh, wow. That makes it more, even more poignant.
Yeah, and when we were working on that series, we had not been able to find them. So I was just thinking as I was listening, praying that they were hearing this because we don't know what happened to them.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you so much.
The Kitchen Sisters have a new book called Hidden Kitchens. The audiobook version includes features from their NPR Hidden Kitchen series.